Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butter fat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice of chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label. And for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
At the time, in the late aughts in Los Angeles, people did not care about food. It was not a cultural thing. It was not, like, most of my coworkers ate Chipotle, Subway, and like, it was just basic.
This is Taste. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. Matthew King is the longtime editor of Eater LA and is plugged into all things in LA's Koreatown. We get into the big topics of the day in Los Angeles and have a spirited conversation about New York City versus LA Koreatowns. I've known Matt for years, and he's been such a good friend and such a great advisor to what's happening in, I would say, Korean food's most important city in America. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Matt Kang, welcome to This Is Taste. Long time coming, my friend. How are you?
Hi.
You've got your notes in front of you. You came prepared. Like any journalist, you come prepared with notes and thoughts. How was your day? What did you have to eat today? Anything good?
My mother-in-law was at her house taking care of our son, Enzo, and she made a tortang, which is sort of like tortang talong, but without the talong, which is the eggplant. And it's basically like a really large Filipino, like, donggurang thing, or like meat jun, basically, with rice. And she's like, you need to eat that with ketchup. And I was like, I will eat it with ketchup. I'm Korean. So I had a Filipino ground pork omelet with rice and some broccoli, which feels so healthy.
That starts the day, like good protein, good balance.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a good home-cooked Filipino meal, not going to complain. On the way here, I was dreaming of all the things I would eat after this interview that's in Silver Lake, because there's a lot of
Silver Lake Strip. We'll get into like LA. I mean, we'll get into so many topics. I mean, your career and what you represent. I mean, I've known you a dozen years, and I just wanted to start by getting a sense of, you know, how did you come to Eater and how did you get started writing about food? I'd like to get for our audience, you know, you've been running Eater LA a dozen years. Is that right?
No, I've been here officially for almost 10 years. In May, it'll be 10 years as the editor. And before that, I was a contributor and like an associate editor.
Wow. Well, a decade is like 40 in media. So
I can't even believe that it's been this long. I'm amazed. I started out just interested in food, interested in writing about food. I studied finance in school and went to business school, and I was in banking. I wore a suit and tie every day and worked in Beverly Hills. And, you know, we had all these celebrity clientele, and I was bored out of my mind.
Right.
You know, just, it's like your whole life, your parents tell you, you should do this. Like, it's good for your career and it's stable or whatever. And I hated every moment of it, you know, being in a cubicle, just crunching numbers, writing bland reports. It was like TPS reports, you know, from Office Space. I was like, this is the dumbest thing ever. And I find no fulfillment in it. But I was making a little bit of money and I wanted to spend the money that a 22-year-old makes, you know. I'm not thinking about retirement and smart investing. I just want to blow all my money on eating at restaurants that I couldn't afford before, you know. And being in LA, like, there's all these restaurants you hear about, like Spago and, you know, Angelini Osteria and all these great places that I never had the money for. So I went out to eat at all these places. And a lot of times I was just trying to find community, people that would go with me or like help me eat. And it was hard. Like at the time in the late aughts in Los Angeles, people did not care about food. It was not a cultural thing. It was not like most of my coworkers ate Chipotle, Subway. And like, it was just basic.
It's such an interesting statement, because I think I first started coming to LA for work around 2007, 2006. And, you know, I've been writing about food since about then, 15 years. And like, you're so right. Obviously, I mean, the town was run by celebrity culture, a handful of celebrity chefs. And I don't think the city was being recognized, at least from the national media, for the diversity of the people here and all the restaurants and all the localities. People were like eating at fast food, right? And we're not understanding that you can go to North Hollywood and have some great Thai food or go out to the SGV.
For sure. I mean, I grew up in LA, so obviously I knew about Korean food and ate at a lot of Korean restaurants, but it never occurred to me that LA could have great restaurants, like, you know, just sort of the stuff that national media covers or whatever. But at the time, I was just like, I want to just eat at as many restaurants and just be a fly on the wall, go sit at the bar, talk to bartenders, talk to servers, and just be an enthusiast.
Love that.
You know, and I think that's kind of like a big process of getting into food is, you know, you want to be an expert right away. You want to be known. You want to be an influencer. But like, I didn't have those aspirations. I just wanted to like pursue this passionately. And I saw it as a hobby.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after a couple of years, I was like, I want to start a food blog because that was like a thing people did. And I always thought of myself as a pretty competent writer.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of the great, you know, food writing works by other authors. And I was like, you know what? I want to try this. And I wanted to start flexing that muscle of blogging. And it was stupid. I was probably a terrible writer. And like my blog, like...
Matatouille, baby.
My blog,
it's
Matatouille.
It's called Matatouille. We gotta stop here and pause and say it's called Matatouille. Like, you can't get away from that one. I mean, it's great.
It was a great blog name. And, you know, it was fun to go around and meet other bloggers in LA and just be part of that culture. Yeah.
Like Food GPS.
Oh, yeah.
Like, who are the guys? Like, Food GPS, like Eater, obviously, was there too. But, like, what else?
Well, I mean, even like Kathy Chaplin with Gastronomy Blog. Oh, I mean, totally. I work with her now at Eater. And there's so many. The list goes on, and I don't need to name them all. But
Zach Brooks.
Yeah. But food blogging was kind of how I got into it. And with Eater, it was like I would throw stories or like tips to Kat Odell, the editor at the time, who was amazing. I loved Eater. Like, I found Eater because in my banking job, I had to read Curbed all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was about real estate development and all that stuff. And so then they would occasionally link to Eater. And I'm like, this is great. This is like no other food publication I've ever seen. It was irreverent and like kind of mean, you know, like they had like the hottest chefs or like Death Watch for restaurants.
Like shitposting, like, before shitposting was a thing. That's what they were doing.
I mean, I don't know about shitposting, but it was mean, you know? Yeah. And I think, not that I like the meanness, but I like the honesty. It felt like it was just so real and instant. And it was a drug because they updated it like 10 times a day.
Yeah.
And like
old school reverse cron style blogging.
Oh my God.
You know, like
quick links, you know, just like a blurb. And it was like the kind of content that I was so addicted to because it was like that. It was meant to feed me and inform me and get me interested. And so, I love just falling into it. I got lucky, you know. Kat was like, hey, do you want to start writing? We'll pay you. I don't even want to say the amount. Yeah. It was a tiny amount of money to write an article. And I was thrilled because that byline was just enough for me. Like, I was like, this is fun.
Yeah, you were a fan of the publication. You got some editing, I'm sure. You like maybe tightened up your chops a little bit.
You know,
generous term.
The blog posts back then were like 50 to 100 words.
So generous, no editing. But but then, okay, so how do you go pro then? Because there's a moment when you realize that the banking job is not really it. And Kat, I'm sure, is like, Matt, you got to come join us. There's got to be a moment in time.
Again, I think it was just luck and not based on my skill or my prowess. And anyway, it was Kat saying, I'm going to get promoted. I'm going to move back to New York. And she'd been living in LA. She's going to do other stuff for Eater. And she was like, do you want to take over my job? And it was very lucky that Eater had been acquired by Vox Media like just a few months prior. And so Eater itself was getting out of that startup phase and becoming like a legitimate real publication, you know, and having a semblance of structure. And so I pretty much latched onto that. I grew with the job. I feel like I'm still learning and I'm still trying to like get a handle of how to do this job.
Even a decade later, you still feel like you're evolving it.
I mean, I was looking back at your guest list and you actually had never interviewed a city editor for Eater, I don't think. I mean, at least prior to the pandemic, up to the pandemic, you hadn't, speaking with Bill Addison and Ryan Sutton and Emma, who's amazing. All these people are amazing. James, Helen Rosner, mm-hmm. all my like former and present colleagues.
Yeah.
But there's something about being a city editor that like I kind of tell people is like being a bureau chief of the CIA outpost, you know? Like you're great. Kind of you are a different part of the company.
Yeah.
And you're very local and you're very focused on what is immediately around you. And you have to be extremely, you know, you're an intelligence officer in a way, right? Because you have to find the tips. You got to know the things. You got to be on top of it. You got to manage a small team.
You're also a diplomat.
You're also a diplomat.
There's a lot of people. There's a national office that has stakes in LA. You've got your local writers and your local community. And you want to make sure you cover the city fairly and that you're doing a good job and being objective. But that's a lot of people, like that definition of objectivity can be sliding at times.
There's a lot to wrestle with because, you know, you're doing the opposite of what a lot of other people in the media do. They're thinking national, what's relevant, you know, what's the best new restaurant in America, blah, blah, blah. And I just don't care about that stuff. I'm only thinking about Los Angeles, what a local audience cares about. And it's frankly something that is kind of dying out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have the LA Times and their food section, which is historic, but it's gone through ups and downs and just had, you know, it just had layoffs recently. You know, local food coverage is its own beast.
Yeah.
And it's been great to kind of navigate through it. And I really appreciate like where Eater LA, how far it's come.
Well, I appreciate you, Matt. And I have to give you a lot of credit for being really consistent in the way that you cover the city, which is tenacious, which is, you know, without any apologies. And I think you obviously haven't made friends with everyone you write about. And that's definitely okay. But I also like what you've done, which is like you've elevated communities like Mexican-American communities, Korean, Thai. You've written stories about SGV. You've written stories about Napa. You've gone up there. You've written stories about, you know, Black community. And, you know, you did that well before these big changes in food media around 2020. You've been doing it since the day one because that's like your instinct. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when 2020 and George Floyd and the sort of backlash against food media that was so, you know, white and hegemonic and very like it was about power. And as a Korean American, as somebody who grew up in LA, who, you know, frankly didn't know shit about West Hollywood or Beverly Hills or these big, you know, kind of glossy places of LA, and instead, you know, being in and spending time in communities that most transplants have never heard of and covering those places and eating at these restaurants, it was always my inclination to be like, you know, these places are just more interesting.
Yeah, agreed. You know? I'm the same way. Yeah.
And, you know, communities, these communities in LA, and this is true of a lot of big cities in America, they're not cooking for a general population.
Mm-hmm.
The Koreans in LA, they don't care about the non-Koreans that come in.
Mm-hmm.
They want to impress and be, you know, serve Korean diners first, and then of course if anybody comes in and they want to try the food, then they just follow. You just buy into that.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of a lot of different international and ethnic communities in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So
let me ask you about Glendale growing up there. Not too far from the traditional Koreatown, but not Koreatown. Let me ask you, what was Korean food like in your household growing up? And I frame this around, you know, Korea World, the book that I'm putting out with Dookie. You're in the book, and Matt, you know, I got to give you so much credit for being such a wonderful friend and resource and collaborator. And we've shared many meals about Korea, you know, in Koreatown in LA, and you know more than anyone. And you gave Jonathan Gold a lot of information firsthand, and I'll give you credit for that too. But what was it like growing up for you? What was Korean food like for you?
Yeah, it was interesting. My parents left Korea. They both left Korea at a young age, and they went to Brazil, and they were both raised in Brazil. They didn't know each other in Brazil, and then they met in the United States. So I feel like I kind of grew up with a weird, stunted Korean kind of American identity. Like, obviously, my parents were still Korean. They're still first generation Korean immigrants, but they were fluent in English. They were very much well-versed in American culture. My dad was like, he sounded like an American dude, which is very rare, you know, for an older Korean American gentleman. And like, we ate steak and like, you know, pasta. Yeah. And like, my dad loved cooking and made pasta and would watch Food Network. And like, PBS and just try to make, you know, mm-hmm. Ming Tsai, just stuff, whatever that yeah. he thought was creative and fun. We had a lot of Brazilian food growing up, a lot of Brazilian barbecue. And it, so it wasn't like a classic traditional Korean.
Yeah.
My mom, you know, she wasn't the best cook growing up. She's a lot better now, you know, now that she's a grandma and like, yeah. you know, has a lot more time to cook. But like growing up, it was very simple stuff, you know, bulgogi and kimchi and banchan that a lot of time they would get from, you know, the markets, yeah. you know, in K-Town. And that was kind of my formative experience with Korean food, was just simple home cooking. I didn't even eat that much of like my grandparents' food. And so my real education of Korean food was from Korean restaurants in Koreatown. Going with my parents, you know, going to get seollongtang, going to get, you know, gogi or jjigae, and like my parents going like, oh, this is kimchi jjigae, like this is why yeah. it tastes like this.
Or like really just telling you this is the way it should taste.
Yeah. And Korean restaurants are amazing just as a concept, because there's such a standard. Like you've eaten now Korean restaurants all over the world and all over the country. And there's something about Korean dishes where there's a certain minimum level of excellence 100. That they will often achieve, you know, and some places will go beyond. And it's weird. There's not a lot of people will argue about it. Like if you have doenjang jjigae somewhere
yeah.
and it's well made,
yeah.
few people are going to be like, well, my mom's version.
Right.
I mean, it might actually be better, but if it's the restaurant level of kimchi jjigae or doenjang jjigae yeah. or seollongtang, then it's just damn good.
Yeah, I fully you know? Agree. I mean, you're definitely at a baseline. And I think my read is like, if you're not, if you're like some reason your doenjang is watery, or your banchan is like you're only offering one or two and not eight or nine, you're out of business.
Totally.
You're out. I mean, I think the only place that really you see these places that are kind of not as high quality is like West Michigan. I wish I could say like my hometown has like truly the worst Korean restaurant in the world. And it's not I'm sorry to say, I think it's just because there's no other restaurant, literally.
It's tough. It's tough. With Korean food in particular, you get this synergy. The more Korean restaurants yep. are there, the more competition.
Great call.
You got to be better. And that's why I think, you know, I love the Korean food in Southern California. It's just grounded in tradition. And it's just the same, you know, 50 grandmas that are all just competing.
I love it.
You know, to make the best version of a dish.
Let's get into the weeds. I want to just get, I asked you this ahead of time. I mean, I know it's hard, but like maybe you have an answer. All-time favorite, like traditional Korean dish.
Man. Yeah, I have an easy answer for that. I love yukgaejang.
Oh, bless yeah. you. What a great dish. Love that.
It's such a like.
Explain it a little bit.
I love yukgaejang. It's basically like a spicy Korean beef soup.
Yep.
It's so texturally interesting because you have like stringy brisket meat, and then you have like stringy fern break, like kozari.
Oh, then, I love that part. I love that.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
And then you have like stringy. It's like, it's just a stringy dish. It's weird. Like you have to bring your floss.
You'll throw some mushroom. I mean, sometimes there'll be like some, like the vegetables will be stringy. It's so stringy. You're right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's like green onion
yeah.
strands. And then there's like, you might like scramble an egg into yeah. it. And then you have vermicelli, which yep. is chewy. And then it's all kind of like suspended in this very dank, like rich, spicy beef broth with like kind of like chili, almost like a, you know, gochugaru, like oil yeah. on the top. It's just very, I don't even know how to make the dish. It's funny. I actually have never tried to make
really?
It. Because it's like, I'm not going to make a better version than the restaurant.
With the restaurant, I mean, we in Koreatown, we have a yukgaejang recipe, and you know, it's like heavy on the gochugaru. I mean, it's
I would
lovely.
Have to look at that recipe,
yeah.
and like, I don't think it'll be better, because no. I'm sure the restaurant, you know, they have their broth nailed down, and it's just a process.
Is Yuday still your place?
Yukgaejang?
Yeah, Yukgaejang, isn't that the place? What's that place?
Yeah, there's a place
on
in
6th
LA.
Street.
There's yeah, that yeah, place. Yeah. So there's a chain in LA called Yukgaejang.
Yukgaejang.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
And they specialize in the dish. And my wife and I probably get it like once every other week. Like, it is so good.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this dish is that it doesn't actually have a lot of interpretation. Like pretty much people make it one way. I've never seen a modern version of it. Yukgaejang puts like ramen noodles in it as like a contrast. Yeah. But like otherwise, it's just very solid. Like I love how consistent it is. It's my like final, like before I, you know, go to heaven.
That's
dish,
the last
you know?
Meal.
Yeah, is yukgaejang.
Well, let's continue talking about Korean restaurants. I want to ask you a few more questions. I guess this is like such a big one too. Maybe it's easy. you know, out-of-towners are coming in. They want to hit the one restaurant for a Korean restaurant in L.A. Matt, where are you taking them?
I always talk about Soban. I mean, I love Soban. I think it's the best Korean restaurant, overall Korean restaurant in Los Angeles, probably my favorite in the country. They have a pretty small menu. It's really centered on three dishes. Kanjang gejang. They do an amazing version of
which
it.
Which is, explain the marinated crab.
It's like a marinated, like sort of fermented. It is fermented technically, but it's like a marinated flower crab. And it's a little bigger and meatier and sweeter than like a blue crab. And it's just this ridiculously delicious dish. I just think of it like cold crab bat. You know, you kind of like squeeze it out. It's like just really complex. There's like all these spices and herbs and flavorings, you know, like antler ear or antler horns. Yeah, and I don't even know what's in it. Just all these things that gives it this very complex flavor. And then you like squeeze it out and you can suck it right out of the carapace or like, you know, spoon it gently over like warm rice.
Always have the warm rice bowl.
Oh,
you spoon it. And then of the marinade, I mean, you can go orchard fruits too. You can get a little bit of like sweetness in there too at times.
Oh, it's like it's a mysterious liquid, but it's mainly soy, right?
So mainly kind of, soy sauce. Yeah.
Yeah. Ganja. So it's got this kind of like soy, but then there's so much complexity in it. They do the best version of that dish anywhere. And they also do a very, very good version of kalbijjim.
Yeah.
And they also do a phenomenal undaegojorim, which is one of my favorite Korean dishes. It's a braised, spicy braised black cod with like these big fat, tender radish slices. And man, like you just get those three things. And like they have their banchan, it starts at 12 and it will go to 16. I mean,
and
it's
the
absurd.
Woman, the young woman running it who took it over from her family, and I'm sure you know her name. She is like really, really focusing on banchan right now.
Deborah and what's her mother. Deborah Pack and her mother, Jennifer, they purchased a restaurant after it was open, but they've just taken it to another level.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like family friends now. They're really wonderful. Yeah. But their banchan game is just, you could just get a bowl of rice and eat their banchan, and that's like the best meal.
I mean, it should be like a meal, and I feel like they could probably, she's very innovative, and I would say probably could do a banchan restaurant. I mean, if there was one.
They could. I mean, Jennifer, the mother, now she like bought a large piece of property in northern LA County and like is like now growing a lot of the the vegetables and like bringing it over and doing a lot of cool stuff.
So Soban, it's definitely a well-regarded place. Matt, I have to ask you for a few more, maybe three or four more Korean restaurants that you really think exhibit LA at its best.
Totally. I mean, I just went last night again to what's that place? Seongbukdong.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like another old school grandma classic Korean food. You know, they have fried fish and they have jjigae and they got kalbijjim. Phenomenal. And they just doubled the size of their restaurant. I didn't even know that had done that. So now I'm like, man, so you're clearly doing well and you're I love Park's Barbecue for Korean barbecue. They do the best version, but there's so many good places. I just went to a new place called Origin, which is where Baekjeong used to be.
Oh, really? Did Baekjeong pull out of LA?
No. It just closed that location.
Oh, the Chapman Plaza one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're going to reopen. So Baekjeong will reopen in a different location. But that one, I just went this week and it was like such a smart reworking of Korean barbecue. As it makes sense for Angelenos.
Yeah.
They have like tteokgalbi there, which is like a very strange, you know, it's not a common preparation. It's just like this ginormous hamburger patty looking thing, but it's just, my son loved it. He was eating the crap out of
There's a great tteokgalbi recipe in Korea World.
Nice.
It's a favorite of mine, and it's one of those dishes that you see everywhere in Seoul, but it's not as common in America.
So like they're trying to make it a thing in LA.
Yeah.
I love that. But like, you know, I really like the new school kind of crop of Korean restaurants, Yangban and Baru and Perilla are very cool in their own way.
Extremely cool, all three of them.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I think, I mean, Korean food, it's I'm always excited by it.
I have to shout out, I'm surprised you didn't mention is Kobowo, the Bosan place.
I mean, Kobowo is definitely super reliable. I think I sent you there.
You sent me there originally, I mean, back in like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've been there maybe maybe four or five times.
They are phenomenal, and you know their posam is unparalleled. Nobody can touch it. It's the best. They're an amazing restaurant for sure.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that Korean talk. We could go all day and make this a Korean episode, but there's so much more to cover. Your job, you know, it's an expansive job. But I want to ask a broad question, and it's a food media question. I think you're really well positioned to answer it. How do you, Matt, and your team, how do you share space with these TikTok backseat reviewers? You know, they're everywhere, and that's like a genre I'm saying. You know, I used to be so optimistic, like, oh man, TikTok's awesome, it's diplomatic, it's cool. But like, I'm like down on it now. I'm like, this stuff is kind of nonsense, a lot of it. And like, these people don't know what the fuck they're talking about, frankly. I'm just going to say it. That's my words, not yours. I just like, how do you share space with them in a very, I would say, competitive food media market?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it's definitely the discussion of the last few years and for this year. For our team in particular is heavily interested in this topic. And I love TikTok.
Yeah.
I love the app. I hope they don't ban it. You know, it's about the time that the government might ban it or force somebody else to buy it. And yeah, I mean, you know, the surveillance aspect is all there. It's Chinese, whatever. Like, in terms of food, in terms of like how we as consumers view TikTok, it is an incredible medium. And if you don't embrace it or appreciate it, like, you're going to get left in the dust. And that means, I think we're being left in the dust.
Yeah.
There is a sort of casualness that's kind of positive, but there's also an inanity. Like, it's just like a guy in a car eating a burger that he took out and he's like rating it. I'm like, that is dumb shit.
Yeah.
That is not, you know, food that I'm not enriched by that.
No.
It's just a hot take or whatever.
It's like empty calories, pun intended.
It's, yeah, exactly. But I do think there's an opportunity. I think that the same way that food media dismissed the blogger generation, of which I was a part of, you know, and I was stupid. I didn't know, you know, I didn't have the food knowledge of like people, you know, Jeffrey Steingarten or whatever. Like, yeah, he would probably slap me, right? If he met me in 2008. But we learned and we got smarter and we got more informed. And we stayed curious. And I think that the TikTok influencer that's going out there and getting hit up by all these restaurants, you want to collab with us? You want to collab with us? I'm like, dude, I'm so tired of that word. Because it's just payola. You know, it's pure pay for play. It's pure like, come, we'll give you a ton of free food and you just have to make us look good. And it's like, you know what? The TikTok influencer is going to only shoot themselves in the foot if they do that, because then the consumer's going to go there and they're going to be disappointed. They're not going to get styled out. They're not going to get the same thing. And you could say the food writer or food media has that same thing. You know, it's not like I go to a restaurant like fully anonymously all the time, or that I don't get made, you know, but it's different. Like, they're presenting something so visually enticing and so wonderful that may or may not align with a normal person's experience. And that takes away its usefulness. It's, the idea is to be service, right? TikTok is trying to be service. 100, you were
the right word, exactly. Service journalism.
But it ceases to be serviceable
when
it's just a one-off experience.
Yeah, and it's like, and I'll just add, I think I fully agree with you, Matt, and I think it's really well said about switching of generations and not being the old guy pointing at the, yelling at the cloud and saying, like, I don't like anything about TikTok. And I, to be clear, I love TikTok as a medium, and I hope it doesn't get banned as well. And I just think that these TikTok backseat reviewers are, like, trying to do it at scale, which is, like, weird. Like, we need to go to, like, 8 places in a weekend and, like, get up all the vids, because obviously they're getting paid by the amount of streams. And so if they are doing X amount per month, they're going to get X amount revenue for their advertising collaboration. So I think that they don't think about it like as a one-on-one the way that food writers think. Like, I'm thinking really heavily about this one story or this one review, and they're trying to scale it, and it's an unscalable piece of content.
Yeah, I mean, I think we will find out what happens. At the end of the day, we just look at the results, and like, certainly places and restaurants are benefiting not only from getting featured on TikToks, but now they're going and saying, let's make our own content. You know, like, your friend Daniel and collaborator Daniel is like killing it with his own pizza content, because you know why? He makes dope ass pizza content. I want to watch him make pizzas and talk about what he cooks. And like, I've been telling that to a lot of restaurants who beg me for coverage or whatever. And I'm like, there's really no avenue, but hey, you are making cool stuff. Show people what you're doing. You don't need me anymore in that sense.
Okay, Matt, let's talk about some storylines in LA. I feel like lot is happening here and you're always on top of it. And I respect your takes. Broadly speaking, is there a story that we just aren't, we meaning the national media, I consider myself part of that, are just not understanding, getting, covering in Los Angeles?
One thing we have visited time and again, and we need to probably look more into, is the sort of financial model of restaurants and how tenuous that is, and looking and trying to understand why there have been so many prominent closures, so many very rapid closures, places that open with huge fanfare and then come crumbling down. Like Best Bet Restaurant was a place that had been in development for 3 years and an ungodly amount of money was spent on it, and it closed out for 6 months.
Wow, that's insane. Why did it flame?
There's a lot of reasons for that, some of which are publicly available to know and many of which is not, you know. But yeah. But the bottom line is that I think a lot of restaurants are struggling. It's a tough, tough market. And there are so many unfortunate forces of, you know, labor, cost, rent, regulation, all these things that just make it impossible for restaurants to truly make it.
Do you talk with the mayor's office and the government of Los Angeles ever? Do you ever get a sense of, does the city have a sense of a strategy to help restaurants stay open? I ask this because in New York, I would say there is zero, and it's frustrating that there isn't a real...
It's a negative 20 in LA. Like you are truly on your own, yeah. And you're truly in trouble when you try to open a restaurant here. I'll give you an example. Like the health department here is managed by the county of LA. So you have one ginormous organization who's responsible for signing off on one thing. Then you have building and safety, and then you have the city in which you're opening, Santa Monica, Culver City, West Hollywood, mm-hmm. Beverly Hills. Those are all independent cities. They're in the county of LA, and then you have the city of LA. It's such a bureaucratic nightmare. There's no streamlined way of doing it. And now there's just there's a market of like expediters and people who will make it happen for you that are not cheap.
Yeah.
Getting liquor licenses or getting all the permits, it's an absolute nightmare. So you're in the hole by hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Wow. And that actually strained that in, it's like in economics, it's called inefficiencies, right? Mm. And so that gets passed on to the consumer. And then the consumer is now dealing with like, hey, why is my burger $40?
Yeah.
Well, it's like your burger's $40 because it has to capitalize the immense expense of just getting this dumb restaurant open.
Yeah.
Right. And also getting people paid. That's not dumb. Paying all the people well, paying all the cooks well, and taking care of everything. At the end of the day, we live in a capitalistic consumeristic society, mm-hmm. and we just look at the bottom line and the price and we're like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. I can't afford this. Right. So all these systemic problems of like basically how restaurants are, you know, are really in trouble coming out of the pandemic, coming out of all that PPP and all that other support. The untold story right now is how many restaurants are gonna stay open and how many of them are gonna fail.
Yeah.
And it's a shocking number. I don't want to be alarmist because I think that some headlines have been very alarmist, but I'm no longer surprised when I see a restaurant close.
You also have a governor who is gonna run for president in 4 years, and it seems like from the state level, there might be some incentive to boost up restaurants.
I don't want to get into politics. I mean, Newsom is Newsom, and like there's that, and it's a complicated system. I think at the end of the day, there needs to be a cohesive way and a logical way for a restaurant operator to open in a place within a timely amount of time, get their gas working, get all their utilities on, everything, permits signed off within a reasonable amount of time, you know, so that they're not just waiting there for months.
Yeah, I bring up Newsom too, but I think it's going to be one of the bigger topics in 4 years, the labor market and how businesses like restaurants remain open with like just prices, inflation will still keep chugging away. I want to segue a little bit more and specifically ask about a chef that we are desperately sleeping on as a population in Los Angeles.
I got to just go to bat for my Korean brothers. Daniel Son of Sushi Sonagi, I'm about to publish a feature on him later today, just an interview.
Oh, hit that publish button.
He's super, I couldn't do it before I got here, but it will happen after this interview. He's doing super cool Korean-American influence omakase.
So cool.
I mean, the guy trained at Noma. He trained at Ryugen, which is like, oh my God, that's insane. Right. Those two. He also trained in a very prominent Northern California, like one of the best omakase places in Northern California, San Mateo. And he opened this small 8-seat omakase, and it just got, like, the Michelin guy just added it to their guide. And I'm like, oh man, now it's going to start. He's going to get a star, and it's going to, his notoriety will get to another level. But I'm really, really proud of him. I think what he's doing is great. Another buddy is a guy, Brian Beck, whose family owns Kobau.
Mm.
And he is like, he was like the prodigal son. He left LA and he went to work at 11 Madison Park and Brooklyn Fair, and he worked at Sushi Nose. And like, is that how you pronounce it? I don't even know. Nas. Yeah.
You redo
Sushi
it.
Nas. You know, he worked at Sushi Nas, and like, he has a little plucky little pop-up called Corridor 109.
I know.
You know?
And, what a crazy name. I love it.
Right. And it's like, if he's well-funded and has a good partner, I mean, he can be the next Kato. You know, he can be the next John Yao in LA.
Yeah.
Doing mostly Japanese, but like obviously sprinkled with Korean. Mm-hmm. And like, he's a hugely talented chef. So I think those guys are really
interesting. Love those calls. What about overrated?
I don't like that word.
I know.
As a concept.
Thank you.
I use it because I'm a hypocrite. But, you know, I would say let's just talk about an aspect of LA dining, which, you know, I would say any celebrity restaurant is just overrated. Like any place that you see, like Craig's, and I know like, Jason just wrote about Craig's. You know, like all these places that are popular celebrity, like, those are overrated. Like I'm tired of them. You know, there is a segment of the LA dining public whose palates are so immature. They are unchained from childhood. And it's freaking mac and cheese and like chicken tenders, and it's just food that's childish, you know? And I went to Cipriani. I love Cipriani as an idea, as a place. It was very suave, very fancy, and the food was infantile. I could not believe how simple it was and so extraordinarily expensive.
Can we say that this is the second time today that Cipriani has taken some strays?
Oh, no. I mean, okay, but I will give Cipriani one nice word, is their veal Milanese is delicious.
All right, getting one right. So Matt, you're out at restaurants and you know, you're giving your takes on like, is this good or is it bad? I love that. But I don't want to let it slip or miss that you report. And there's always reporting happening and there's always features happening at Eater LA. It's not just like short pieces. So I'd love to get a sense of maybe the last couple months, have you guys broken any news? Have you gotten any scoops? Are there any big reported pieces you want to shout out? I love reading LA.
Thank you. There's been so many. I couldn't actually think of that many that I had done personally, but the sort of second generation of Koreatown restaurants was the big enterprise piece that I did late last year. And it was a story I'd been gestating on for probably 4 years.
Yep.
Matt Buchanan, you know, the former executive editor, was like, you need to do the story. Like, this is important. And I did it 3.5 years later, which was about the sort of what happens to Koreatown when its first generation of owners retires. And are these kind of classic mom and pop restaurants, when they go away, then what, like, is Koreatown going to lose its goodness, you know? And it was thankfully like finding a second generation of owners who were taking over for their parents or maybe a relative, or, you know, carrying the mantle of like good Korean food in Los Angeles, which it was like a piece that made me really happy to do. I don't think it was like super well read, you know, it wasn't like viral, but like I considered it one of the most important things I'd done. And I want to keep exploring that. Your books really kind of touch a lot on that notion of like who carries Korean food, you know, who represents it and who speaks for it. And I'm fascinated by it. I think your books are obviously phenomenal, and I'll talk more about it later. But that was a great one. And then just like very recently, this like Benny Blanco story.
Oh, cool.
Like, I don't know Benny Blanco, but I remember I went to a pop-up like a few years ago at John and Vinny's, and it was like, Justin Bieber and Benny Blanco collabed on a sandwich. And I was like, who's Benny Blanco?
Yeah.
I want to meet Justin Bieber and I want to eat his sandwich, but I don't care about Benny Blanco. But he's like now obviously emerged as like an incredible like force on social media and food, and his like probably sarcastic or like horribly racist, however you look at it, you know, take on Jollibee was a story that I wrote about. It was originally only picked up by like Filipino publications.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, that his experience with Jollibee went viral, naturally received an incredible amount of condemnation from Filipinos. And as somebody who just like went to the Philippines, I was just there for 11 days with my family. Yeah, man, that was messed up.
Yeah,
dude.
That was
that is so messed
up. Don't review restaurants while you're high. Don't go after entire ethnic groups with your statements. And also, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say about a national chain, it's probably best to not say it, though we are recording this in the Doughboys studio in Los Angeles, and that is their brand. So shout to the Doughboys. But I have to say, I loved that people like were like, fuck Benny Blanco for writing about Jollibee in a negative way. Now, listen, I haven't had like the best food at Jollibee personally, but fucking I'm never going to say it like him. Like, you know, you can do it in a way that like, you know, is not a total dumbass move. And I feel that's like part of your job is to make sure that, you know, in celebrities and influencers, when they're writing about food, that you're either praising it or not. It's like part of the remit for Eater LA.
My friend said it really bad. I had a buddy of mine who was talking to on the phone about this, and he was like, there is almost no other food thing in the world that's, you know, not more attached to a culture and its people than Jollibee. Like that clearly represents Filipino food and Filipino culture. So you don't shit on it.
Dude,
like,
don't.
It's just that comes off as racist. And I don't know, think that's what he intended.
No.
He was trying to be funny. I get it. But it was a misfire. And then he tried, it almost hurt that he tried to remedy it the next day. I felt like that was like almost worse. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it was mainly just like, oh my gosh, like as an eater, you know, just observing it from an editorial perspective. I'm sure most people will forget about it.
Yeah, everyone will,
you know,
probably
whatever.
Forget about it now,
but it was a good lesson of like, hey man, like, this is, you know, this is a food that a lot of people care about.
Yeah.
Don't shit on it if people care about
Which is like back to the TikTok conversation. It just isn't oftentimes the best place to like review restaurants. There's like plenty of great things about TikTok and food, but when it comes to these like reviews, they're usually pretty problematic.
Who's reading off a script? You know, like
totally.
Who writes something, edits it? It's not like when you know, have something on television or like in whatever,
that's
even
produced.
Local news that's produced. No, man, like they're just going off the cuff. Not unlike this conversation, but hey, I at least wrote down my answers so I can.
I love it, Matt. You know? came to play. We got a few more questions. I love this. Is there a cuisine you're thinking is like having a bigger moment in LA right now? At least reported from the inside. It could be a community, could be, you know, a cuisine from another country outside of America. Could be like hybridized cuisine. What do you think?
I think there's something kind of nascent right now, but will grow bigger, is a lot of African cuisines, actually. So, you know, LA has Little Ethiopia and has had Nigerian, Somali, and some other African cuisines here, but they were never like prominent until fairly recently. And so Tolu Eros, who's like the billionaire chef, and another chef from San Francisco that opened a place here, Simi Adebayo, and also like Ethiopian restaurants. This is a category that I think
so cool.
is still very like ripe for exploration and growth in LA and interest. And I'm fascinated by it. I the Nigerian and Ethiopian food that I have had is delicious.
Yeah,
it's such a different worldview from the prominent cuisines in LA, which are Latin American and Asian, very clearly. But now we're seeing African influence, the rise of African culture in, you know, across the world. I think I'm big on Africa. Like if Africa had a stock, I would buy that stock. You know,
that's
because
great.
I think that within the next 100 years, I think the continent and its most prominent cities and cultures are going to, you know, dominate.
I have to give you a little bit of space to shout out the South Bay. Because you moved there in the last 5 years, and you've taken me around, and man, I've had, I think, some of the best food in all of LA. in the South Bay. So let's give it a little bit of space, Matt. What's going on there?
I moved to South Bay. I moved to Torrance. Yeah, man, it's a fun place. Like the neighborhood and the areas there have great mom and pops, great food. It's like, it's still not cohesive.
Yeah.
So as an LA person driving around, poking into strip malls, going like, oh, I haven't seen that one before. You know, you drive up, kind of open the door. Like that sense of mystery and exploration is still there in the South Bay. And I love that as somebody who moved there in the last 8 years. It's thrilling to just be able to find cool places, many of which have, you know, are entrenched in their communities and beloved.
Yeah.
But for me as like a food writer, I don't know of another prominent food writer that's based in the South Bay.
Is there a restaurant you would point to in the South Bay that we just have to
pick out? Oh, there's so many. Anything Japanese, but like Otofuku is
great.
Went
last night.
Hachi. Well, you went to Otofuku last night?
Last night, man. I was
down the street from my house. You didn't call me?
I should have. I just went to a trade show and I had to be back to prepare for these podcasts. Yeah, Otofuku last night was pretty fire, man. I love that place.
It's just like, I just love the whole vibe. You know, yeah. You're going through the back.
Yeah.
You go there. You're pretty much the only non-Japanese person there. Yeah. And a lot of people are like wearing suits because they just came out of work.
Yep. And they had like the guy next to me had his bottle of shochu that he had his name like was taped to the bottle, and he went there weekly and we chatted about it.
That's amazing.
Real neighborhood place.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the South Bay is interesting. It's also near the beach, so there's a lot of beachy stuff. I don't know. It's fun. I like living there.
Man, on This Is Taste, we ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid fire Fast and Furious taste check. Are you ready?
Let's go.
The best fruit.
Durian.
First time mention on the show. I'm gonna just like ask you why.
It's the best. It's absolutely the best fruit in the world.
I'm all for it. I think it's an enchanting fruit.
It's unbelievable. It's also inaccessible for me. So when I do eat it and it's like in Southeast Asia, yeah, then I'm like, this is the greatest.
Did you have some in the Philippines on your trip?
You know, I didn't. I'm a terrible hypocrite. But part of it was just because I was so busy.
Yep.
And it was just hard to get around to it. And, you know, chasing around a toddler,
yep,
takes away a lot of your will to do anything.
The worst vegetable.
I'm going to say bitter melon.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get into it.
It's a real delicacy.
My Filipino in-laws are like, they're just, and I eat it gladly, yeah, but.
You don't prize it the same way. The best dessert.
Chocolate souffle.
Interesting. Is there a place in LA that you can get it or do you make it?
Cut.
Yeah.
It's like $30. It's ridiculous.
For a souffle, that's like the food cost on that is like 6 cents.
Yeah, but the labor cost is probably high.
I'm
but
kidding. I would never never judge a restaurant by its margins.
It's probably three times what it needs to cost, but it's still
whatever.
Delicious.
Your favorite American fast food chain?
In-N-Out.
Spoken like a true Angeleno. Have you had a Shake Shack ever?
Hundreds of times.
What do you think about Shake Shack?
You're going to bait me into that? I mean, it's not even close. I've had 100 conversations about this, Matt. There's no comparison in my mind. I've had In-N-Out 10,000 times, and I've had Shake Shack hundreds of times in my life, okay? The first one was a hyperbole. I've definitely had it a lot.
Yeah.
I think both are good.
Yeah.
I will defend In-N-Out because I think it is what I believe encompasses the best of what fast food can,
yeah,
be.
Listen, buddy, we're gonna take this to a stage one day. We're gonna get a live audience and we're gonna do it in like the Midwest in neutral territory, and what? Then we're gonna see, because like we can't do it in New York or LA, and then we're gonna see what people say. I wonder what the Midwesterners think. Anyways, moving right along. Your favorite Los Angeles restaurant right now.
You're not gonna like this, but I'm gonna say Republic.
Why am I not going to? I love Marty Mansky.
Oh,
are you kidding me?
I thought you didn't have a great experience the last time.
That's untrue. I actually had a great experience. Okay. I really like Republic a lot. And I think I was mentioning it with Phil Rosenthal, who obviously is an owner of the restaurant, but I feel like it's such a consistent restaurant. So I think you might be mistaken.
Okay. I think maybe it was because you went during the pandemic and it was just weird. But no, Republic, I recently went for the first time for dinner. In years.
Yeah.
And I was blown away by it.
Yeah.
It was so good. Just a great experience. My arteries did not appreciate me.
It's a heavy meal. I love breakfast there, though. That's probably what I have more.
Yeah.
The counter, the pastry counter is amazing. Yeah. Sad about BC Clat closing. kind of sad.
Real bummer. I mean, BC Collette and Mansky were phenomenal.
Mansky as well, right. Your favorite non-LA California restaurant?
I'm going to say Kasama.
Yeah.
I was going to say Parachute, but they're closed now.
Yeah.
And so I recently went to Chicago. Kasama, went for brunch. Brilliant. Brilliant restaurant.
I really, really, really like Kasama a lot. And I think what the Bear did was pretty great for those guys.
I didn't watch that. I don't know. I need to watch the Bear. I need to watch the
It's on the show.
The
it's
Bear.
Pretty great.
Okay, good. I will.
Okay, this is a hard one. Your favorite LA neighborhood for food?
K-Town.
Yeah, that's easy. I mean, maybe it's not even a hard one. It's an easy one. Your favorite cookbook of all time?
K-Town. I actually wrote that. I really do.
You wrote my book from 2016 with Dookie Tom. Thank you very much, Matt. You've been such a great sport with the book, and we'll talk more. We're going to be appearing in LA in July at the LA Public Library.
Yeah.
We got to confirm that, but that's going to happen. We'll mention it in the podcast. Yeah. But
I actually have an unbiased answer.
Okay.
Which is the Cook's Illustrated Baking Book.
Oh, yeah.
That thing is amazing. That's like, I started making the banana bread from there. That's like, I've turned heads with that thing.
That's cool.
The recipes in that book are amazing. They're really well thought out, really easy to do. Like, we didn't really dive deep into recipes, which I'm sure you do with a lot of your guests. Yeah. But like, yeah, I would say I have a lot of cookbooks. I like to use cookbooks. That one is my favorite one.
Yeah. Well, you're a really great home cook. I've watched you've done some video content and you're great, man. I hope maybe that's like the second or third chapter of your career is going into the recipe game.
Somebody was mentioning, I think Lucas was telling me, he's like, you could leave restaurants and just do, like, he knows that I'm very into cooking.
You are, yeah.
I like recipes. But I don't think they get, it just doesn't get me as excited on a regular basis as restaurants.
I'm the same way, Matt. I think restaurant, like the culture of a restaurant, the pageantry, you know, learning about new cultures through food and restaurants, there's nothing, you can't beat them.
Recipes are like a world in which you have to explore when restaurants aren't available to you, I think.
Yeah.
You know, if you live in Arkansas, no shade to Arkansas, but like my sister-in-law lives there.
Yeah.
They don't, it's hard to get excited about the dining scene there.
Yeah.
So you got recipes and she cooks a lot. We're in LA. Like, I don't need to cook.
You're
here.
In LA. I mean, you go to like, you know, parts of upstate New York and you're going to be like kind of struggling for restaurants. So yeah, like you're in a city, you're in a restaurant city, man. Yeah. Your favorite city outside America to visit for food?
I'm going to say Bangkok.
Such a good city.
It's amazing.
Your favorite sandwich?
So Langer's pastrami, but not the number 19. Langer's pastrami with cream cheese and tomato on rye.
I love cream cheese sandwiches, so thank you. But I haven't been to Langer's in years, so this is...
You have to try this sandwich. It is so sloppy and so horrific as a concept. But it's brilliant because I just love the richness from the cold cream cheese. And then you get like, you have a big thick slice of tomato. It makes no sense. I've never seen it anywhere else.
It sounds, I mean, I've never seen it either. I'm like, my mind is kind of twisted right
now. It's blown. It will, you won't eat the whole thing. But when you have the half of it, you're going to be like, this is a phenomenal creation.
I love
creation.
A half and then half for later.
Exactly.
Matt Kang, thank you so much for joining This Is Taste.
Thanks for having me.
This Is Taste is hosted by Eliza Abarbanel and me, Matt Rodbard. The show is produced by Shalia Harris and Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for updates on all cool things that are happening.